like to introduce our speaker, the lovely Dr. Beverly Allen, who's spoken with us before. The topic of her talk today is A Snake in the Grass, A History of Renewal. For those of you who haven't had the lovely opportunity of hearing Beverly before, she's a professor of French, Italian, and comparative literature emeritus at Syracuse University, where she held the William P. Tolley Distinguished Teaching Professorship. She has also taught at Stanford, Cornell, the University of Zagreb, and the GTU in Berkeley. Her books, edited volumes, and articles treat literature and culture and in rape warfare extend to war crimes in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Her recent work deals with the sacred feminine, and she also knits and plays with her grandchildren. So thank you, and please welcome Dr. Allen.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you to the Personal Theology Group. Thank you to UUCB. Thank you so much, Lonnie. Thank you for your talent and art with our technology and your great spirit. And Anne, likewise, it's so wonderful to know you. I want to welcome everyone to my kitchen. So I have my Swedish horses here, and I hope it's colorful enough to keep everyone joyful. This is a difficult time sometimes to be joyful, and I often give myself a break from trying to be joyful, and I think of the Book of Lamentations in the Hebrew Bible, and I think of Job, and I think of, it feels so good to lament. So I give myself permission to do that as well. But today, I want to give us all a break from the present and take us on a very informal and casual, let's say, almost intuitive little travel through time. And I'm going to begin by reading a poem from Walt Whitman, which is a hymn. It's a hymn of praise to the cycle of life. So please just take a little vacation from all your worries while I read this poem to you. It's from Song of Myself, number 6. A child said, "What is the grass?" Fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners, that we may see and remark and say, whose? Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white, Kanuk, Tuckahoe, Congressman, Cuff. I give them the same, I receive them the same. And now, it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. Tenderly will I use you, curling grass. It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be you are from old people or from offspring taken. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them soon out of their mother's laps. And here you are, the mother's laps. This grass is very dark to be from the white heads of old mothers, darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. Oh, I perceive, after all, so many uttering tongues, and I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouths for nothing. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women, and the hints about old men and mothers, and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death, and if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it, and ceased the moment life appeared. All goes outward and onward. Nothing collapses, and to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Well, what we see in this poem is the grass. And I would like to suggest that the snake was also there once. And that once upon a time, any conceptualization of this vast cycle that includes birth and death and everything in between was symbolized powerfully by the snake. So let's go now to share screen. And I'm going to show you some images. So I'm calling this the snake in the grass. And I purposely chose a title that I thought would be a little threatening. Because when we think of snakes now, we often feel terrified. And I want to also mention that I'm really speaking from a perspective of what once upon a time we called Western culture. I've spent my life studying it, and I'm no expert on anything else. But today I want to show you the history of the disappearance of the snake in the West, in Western culture. And what we lose as she becomes terrifying is, I believe, a possibility for us to actually experience the power of the patriarchal takeover over millennia. So let's just see what comes next here. There's our grass, beautiful but missing. Missing, I say, the snake. So in this methodology that I propose, which is really associative spirituality or associative interpretation, something that Jung talks about as he talks about the interpretation of dreams, we see a snake in all cultures where snakes exist in nature. And they are not demonized everywhere. But let's go back to prehistory. And our guide in this will be Maria Gimbutas. Maria Gimbutas was an anthropologist from Lithuania who taught for the last part of her career at UCLA. She participated in a great many excavations in what she called Old Europe, which nowadays would be what we call Central Europe. Maria Gimbutas is a controversial figure in academic circles. I think that this controversy that she elicits is due mainly to two things. One would be a kind of intuition that she gave credit to, her own intuition. And secondly, it would be her conviction that these prehistoric cultures that she studied in mainly those two places, actually had a kind of alphabet. I would be willing to accept the controversy surrounding the notion that they had an alphabet, because I haven't been convinced of that yet. However, her intuitive scholarship seems to me an unrecognized part of what all scholars do. We read and we learn and we investigate and we research. And as we do all that, something else is at work in us that tells us, oh, this is interesting. Let's go and look at that. And all the forces that come into that kind of sense or intuition do play a role. Intuition itself then plays a role. So it's not perhaps all purely reason that guides us. Well, I talked about the prehistoric presence of snakes, but we're gonna look first at, this is Anatolia, and here's a place called Çatalhöyük. At Çatalhöyük, we have remarkable excavations in which Stanford University is a main participant. And Çatalhöyük has excavated an entire village. It's probably the oldest agricultural village that we see in ruins now. And Çatalhöyük, it turns out, looked something like this. People did not use the roads much. They went from one house to another over the roofs, but they began a kind of mixed economy, which was both hunter-gatherer and agriculture. Now, in a typical house in Çatalhöyük, you have often this kind of figure of a bear. And a very prevalent figure is the ox. And then, of course, the stairway up to the roof or the road. The people hunted leopards. And I say the people because, as far as one can tell, men and women participated in that. You have interesting, whatever they are, living rooms or birthing rooms, where people could lean back against these supports made of ox horns. Here's a photograph of one of the excavated homes. The exit provides not only an access to the roof, but also a place for the smoke to go from the cooking oven. And here is one of the most impressive figurines found in Çatalhöyük. Now, it's about this tall, and it's in the museum in Ankara right now. And we see here a very exaggerated female form. So the exaggeration, we say, indicates, great fertility. Oh, I got ahead of myself here. Sorry. She's got also the leopards here in her throne. She's got a throne made of leopards, so she's very powerful. And here we have her pubic triangle, exaggerated breasts, exaggerated hips, and seen from the back, it's also very exaggerated buttocks. And here, this might be, it's impossible to tell, but it might be a baby getting born. I do not refer to this figurine as a goddess myself. And the reason is that I don't think we can know whether people who lived 8,000 or 9,000 years ago had a notion of goddess or god. What I do see is that they are very aware of kinds of energy that surround them in nature. And they see in this exaggerated human fertility what they observe in their agricultural endeavors, which is a seed drops into the ground, it goes underground, and then after a while it sprouts and it grows and it reaches maturity and it provides food or flowers, whatever, and then it wilts and dies and goes back into the ground again. But then the next season, the next growth season, it comes up again. Well, from Chacahuilluc, we have one snake so far. And it's a bit of a mystery. What is this snake doing on this person's head? And we don't know, is that a man or a woman? I don't think it matters at this point. The snake, however, matters. And now we get more clues by going into what Gimbutas called Old Europe. Old Europe is, well, you see, here's Italy over here. So it's really what we call Eastern Europe now, and Romania, and et cetera. So here we're looking, we're going to look at the Cucuteni culture and surrounding cultures, because now we're about 2,000 years closer to the present. And look what we find. We find a Vinca culture that spreads out all the way to the Adriatic. Here you see Bosnia, Croatia, Belgrade, Sofia, well, Bucharest. And look what they made. Here's a little figurine, very different from what we saw in Chacahuilluc. Nonetheless, exaggerated features, exaggerated hips, pubic triangle, very well delineated. Are these her arms or are these her arms? But it's definitely female. Now, Gimbutas sees in undelineated arms like this, she sees the influence of a snake figure. Here's another figure from Chacahuilluc in which the pubic triangle is prominent. So we have, as far as shapes are concerned, the triangle and circles. And then these less delineated, more abstracted arms and legs and feet. And here is what most people who think about these things would recognize as a Cucuteni figure, because now we have line drawings all over it. And what you can see is that the basis of the line drawings are already here. They're already here in the pubic triangle that's divided. So here we have pubic triangle, but exaggerated. And this later, this exaggeration later leads to an appearance of apron-like garments on some of these figures. But this is clearly more important than realistic representations of the human body. We don't see a head, really. The arms are truncated. What does matter is the V, the triangle. Right side up, upside down, triangles everywhere you look. Here's another Cucuteni figure, and here you see the accompanying importance of the circle or the spiral. And now we're really looking at something reminiscent of snakes. Here also. And look at these arms. They just don't matter so much. You can tell their arms coming forward. We don't see them in the back. The back I don't know if those are supposed to be, I don't know, who could know? But you know that this is important. I mean, I say I don't know if these are breasts or not because they're on the back, but certainly the buttocks become spiral circles, the triangles everywhere. So the female figure from 5000 BC in Romania gets noticed by the designer Naeem Khan in 2014 in New York. Look at that. Look at that. Whoops, a little too quick here. So we have the pubic triangle. We have the side, we have it repeated on the sides. We have variations on the triangle. We have everything. He should have paid them royalties, but they weren't around anymore. Here we have Cucuteni figurines. Now, you can see that what matters here is the triangle, or maybe this whole thing is now a triangle. Perhaps it's been suggested that these are phalluses. The upper part of the female figure, it's clearly still female, may be phallic. The Cucuteni culture does not ignore the phallus, but it keeps fertility in a female figure. Well, as such, the female figure of a human is associated in this culture with various animals. So here we see a bird. You see the beak and the eyes. And as Gimbutas teaches, you have the classic, let's say, the traditional aspects of the female fertility, but a head of a bird. Well, the bird had become a symbol of that fertility because the bird laid eggs. People observed how that happened. People observed the cycle of the bird life. And here we have some, I think, very cute Cucuteni figurines. This is a bird. And here, this is an ox. Now you see the ox. The Cucutenis would often put ox horns outside caves where we assume they worshiped. They did not bury their dead in caves. They put their dead, perhaps after leaving them outside to be, I can't think of the official word, but to be, to desiccate and be eaten by animals. But then they buried the bones under their beds in their homes. So they kept them in their homes. This one, I'm afraid we can't tell what it is because it's such a blurry image. But you see this triangle and now how it's grown. So it's almost like a girdle all the way across. And the breasts. Okay, here's the next one. Here we have a snake head. Look at that. And the triangle. And the triangle repeated up here. So what matters in this one is the snake. Now, why does the snake become a symbol of this principle of cyclic renewal? Well, for one thing, the snake sheds its skin on a regular basis and gets new skin. For another thing, the snake can make a circle. It can take its tail and its mouth and form a circle. And that corresponds to the agricultural cycle. It corresponds to everything that people start observing in themselves and their own modes of reproduction. So the snake is a symbol of fertility. Here we have a number of these. You see the triangles? This is all representation of that symbol, those symbols for the sacred, what I call the sacred feminine. The bird, the stork, the snake. Here we have a frog. Frog is very important in the symbolism of this feminine fertility, because the frog exists in water, and water is another symbol for that fertility, as is the fish. If I do a whole course on this, we could look at all the fishes. They're so cute. Here now, we're back to the snake. Now look at her. And here is my favorite. Kukutani culture has Madonna and child as snakes. Madonna and child. Here we have, once again, the pubic triangle growing into a kind of apron. We have the breasts, and she's holding the little baby, and the baby is a snake, has a snake head, and she has a snake head. I shouldn't say the baby is a snake. The baby is a human baby with a snake head. So this brings to the human baby all the regenerative symbolism and energy, I would say, of the snake. Now, as to these bumps on her outfit, I call it an outfit, we don't know. And Gimbutas doesn't suggest anything. So that's a mystery for now. And here's another snake head from Kukutani culture. Let's just go back to the Madonna for a minute. And just take her in. This is a centrally symbolic figure in what we call Western culture. And I was certainly surprised myself to find it here as associated with snake. Now we jump ahead to Minoan culture. And we see that the snake appears held by, now we have a goddess, okay? So we call her a goddess. I suppose the Minoans may have done so. But what happens when goddesses appear, for one thing, is that the power of that original feminine fertility imagery and energy, which includes the wisdom of all of nature, or implies that, gets broken up into this and that. The goddess of wisdom, the goddess of childbirth, the goddess of the harvest, the goddess. So let's just look a little bit at some of the things that, some of the history of that. Here, do we see the pubic triangle? Why, yes, we do. There it is. And now it's more of an apron. And we see the circles of her breasts. And she's holding the snakes. And this may be a phallus. But clearly the snakes are important. And I say she has inherited them. Here's perhaps a better image, a better photo of that image. Oh, sorry, that's a cat or a leopard maybe. And a phallus, why not? Look at that. Minoan culture also continues the, let's say, sacrality of the ox or the bull. And we see those famous horns back from Çatalhöyük, all that long, long way back. And of course, Kukutani culture. And now the young men, these are young men, are doing acrobatics and risking their lives. So already in Minoan culture, the play with the bulls, contains some of the energy and risking of death that goes back to Çatalhöyük, hunting of bulls. But I also noticed that the figures of these men contain, they're kind of triangular. So the triangle is a very present figure. Here also in Minoan culture, we have the famous story of the labyrinth. So you can see that this is similar to the Kukuteni spirals and has taken on a new significance as almost a kind of puzzle or something that leads to the sacred place. Now we're coming forward in time to Sumer, ancient Sumeria, and here we have the city of Uruk, which is the location in our oldest epic, our oldest written text, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Babylon is up here. So we have urbanization happening. Here's Ur. Now in that poem, in that epic, we see that Gilgamesh is very destructive. I mean, very, not destructive. He's very, very disrespectful to the goddess Ishtar. Disrespectful. So he's trashing her, in other words. But look at her. Here are some, perhaps, leopards. Here she has bird feet, feathers, wings, and some people see in this configuration of this goddess who lasted for a long time and had many names, the predecessor of the seraphim in Egyptian and especially Hebraic cultures. Here we have owls. Here we have an ankh predecessor. And here we have snake. So she hasn't made these up. Most very prominently, the pubic triangle. This is not covered. This is essential. And in Greece, the symbol of the snake is adopted by Asclepius and the notion of healing. So from what we've seen of our snake since Kukuteni and Çatalhöyük, we see that it's associated with renewal, which of course would be the notion of healing. And here it's also associated with a rod. I'm gonna try to talk for about 10 minutes more before we open to questions. I want to go through this. This is obviously very rapid. Greece also gives us further demonization of the snake. I say, well, it's the beginning, I suppose, of demonization of the snake, because when we see the snake in Minoan culture, it hasn't yet been demonized. When we see Asclepius using it, no, it's a health symbol. It's a healing, a symbol of healing. But here it is demonized, and it's demonized in a very patriarchal way because it represents the hair on the face of a female who merely to be seen by a man will turn him to stone. That's Medusa. Then we have the Renaissance, which began in Italy, not England. And this gorgeous statue, which was a miracle of casting, by the way, by Cellini, of Perseus slaying Medusa. So all the beauty here is masculine and has nothing to do with fertility, but it does have to do with death, which going back is part of the cycle. So perhaps unknowingly, it perpetrates the cycle. All right, going way back again to prior to the Common Era, We want to look at the Israelites, Semitic-speaking Israelites, who some consider to have been quite what we would associate with Africa now, African in appearance. Let me go back to the Israelites. I'm going to the Israelites worship Isis under another name, and you can find references to that worship in the Hebrew Bible. You can find it in Leviticus, I think it's 44, but there are other locations, textual locations. And mostly these references are injunctions against having statues of the goddess in the Hebrew temples. Get rid of it, you know, don't worship, don't be idolaters. Take her out of your temples. But for several centuries, the Israelites worshipped both their god Yahweh and this goddess of the Middle East. Skipping around a bit, we come to Germany and the demonization, really definitive, I suppose, of the snake in the second story of the creation. Well, this is actually still Hebrew, Israelite invention. As many of you know, there are two creation stories in the book of Genesis. So the first one counts the days. On the first day, God did this. On the second day, on the seventh day, he was pleased with what he had created and he rested. But not far after that comes the story of the Garden of Eden, where we see nature in a sort of pristine form. And a snake comes and tells the woman, the secondary human being, secondary in all things from now on, to enjoy nature, to taste of the tree of knowledge, to eat the apple. So the snake tempts her, and she does. And from then on, humans are cast out of nature. Well, you can see by following even this rough sketch that I'm giving you today, there's a tremendous distance between humans as a part of nature and a part of the cycle of life and death and life and death and just constant renewal. Well, birth, growth, death. Humans are now absolutely separated from that. And that happens in the Semitic Hebrew culture, which also gives us the story of Moses, who doesn't want to lead his people. And there's a snake on the ground. And God, Yahweh, says to Moses, pick up the snake. And as he picks it up, it turns into a rod. And the rod becomes a symbol of his leadership and his power. So if we want to follow the line I've been tracing for you here, he's taking over the sacred feminine. And there's an awareness in this story of what the snake symbolizes, as there is such an awareness in the story of the Garden of Eden. This is the old truth of how life constantly renews. And now the patriarch is picking it up and it becomes a symbol of the ruler. Or Charlton Heston, if you wish. That's what's become of the snake. Now, the Israelites didn't give up the sacred feminine, although they were forbidden to worship Astarte in their temples. But they found the energy of the feminine in what they call the Shekinah. Now, I'm sure there are people here today who know a lot about the Shekinah, but the Shekinah is the appearance of God in the temple. So God comes into the temple when rituals of worship are performed in the energy of the feminine. And here in this drawing anyway, the feminine has wings. So we have that hearkening back to a symbol of the feminine. Here's Dante Gabriel Rossetti's vision of the Shekinah. And he gives her a pubic triangle. Who knows if he intended that or not. But his very romantic imagining of the Shekinah does hearken back to the ancient cultures. Then, with Christianity, we have an operation that even after the complete demonization of the snake goes further by demonizing the feminine. So we know that in early Christianity, women played major roles in the churches that were springing up all over Europe, all over Christendom. But in the Council of Nicaea, in the 4th century of the Common Era, it was determined that Mary Magdalene, who had been a major figure in the story of the life of Jesus, and who now, given the appearance and study of the Nag Hammadi texts, we can see was perhaps his teacher herself, and also perhaps his wife. That was intolerable for a church that was now patriarchal and modeling its organizational structure after that of the Roman Empire. So never mind that she had been so important, in the canonical gospel stories of the life of Jesus, that she was the one he visited first after his resurrection or renewal, or after he shed the skin of the mortal coil and was about to ascend to heaven. Mary Magdalene, by the way, is associated with colors that traditionally are associated with this sacred feminine principle. She has red hair. She wears red. This is all in contrast to the Virgin Mary. This grows over the centuries. She has red hair. She wears red. And she's often pictured with an urn. Now, the interpretations of that urn are many. For example, one interpretation says this contains the oil with which she anointed his feet with her hair at a banquet in a gospel story. Or another says this is the urn that contains the oils that she used to put on his body prior to his burial. Or another more radical theory says she was adept, having been a priestess of Isis, she was adept at drugs and using plants that could drug people. And having been also an Essene, she had used these drugs to participate in rebirth ceremonies, so the drugs would induce a sleep-like state that could last for 3 days while the initiate was in an underground tomb. And then after 3 days, the sponsor of the initiate would go descend to the tomb and bring the initiate out. And so that interpretation gives a different, a very non-traditional reading of the story of Lazarus in the Bible, which would say that that Yeshua or Jesus had been the sponsor, the ascetic sponsor of Lazarus, who was Magdalene's brother, and brought him out of the tomb, or quote, raised him from the dead, unquote. All right, so Magdalene is, the stories about Magdalene are very many because she was the figure that this group, put broadly, had to eliminate. They couldn't allow anyone that important who was a female. So they interpreted the stories of, in the gospel. You know, never mind that when Yeshua casts out the demons, he casts out demons that appear in the chakras of Magdalene. Never mind these stories. She's now cast as a prostitute, a whore, and then a penitent. So you can still respect her because you can respect someone who was so very evil, and then repents. However, as time goes on, we find hints that there are different thoughts about Magdalene. This is one of my favorite paintings of her. We've got, 15th century Lombard painter who does something quite radical and has her looking right at me, whoever me is. There's her urn. There's the empty tomb. Is she looking at Yeshua? Am I standing in the position of Yeshua? Or is she implying to me that she has just seen something she won't be talking about? Or something else? Well, the Madonna and Child becomes a bedrock symbol of Christianity, and hence the culture that grows up in Europe and spreads where Europeans go. This is the Madonna, the Virgin. She has to be a virgin because she can't be a prostitute. And those are the only two roles left for women. At this point, the sexuality of women, and hence the fertility of nature, is completely separated from actual human bodies. So we have the birth of Yeshua, or Jesus, who in the West is God and man, and his mother is a virgin. So this is a miracle birth, has nothing to do with the actual human observation of how nature works. Now and then, we come across, however, versions of the Madonna and Child that don't look like the Virgin Mary. Can you guess who this looks like? She has red hair. She's wearing red, not blue. And if you want to trace the hidden history of Magdalene as a symbol of human fertility, you can see that this could very well be Magdalene. Additionally, this little Jesus looks awfully grown up. And here we see an inverted triangle, plus many other triangles. Now, you can accuse me. I was going to say, don't accuse me of a conspiracy theory, but I think you may. That's fine with me. And what we find shortly after this is the Black Madonnas. They occur all over Europe. And people have spent oceans of ink on trying to say what they mean. But one thing that Gimbutas teaches is that when something is black, when we see black figures like this, these are not necessarily realistic figures. They are symbolic. And when we see the black, we can assume the black means that something is hidden. Something is hidden. So here we have a Black Madonna wearing the color of the Virgin, but also hidden underneath the lining is the color of Magdalene. So the snake continues. It gives us the symbol for infinity in two ways. St. Patrick, unfortunately, goes to Ireland and chases the snake out. This is for you, Nancy. Chases the snakes out of Ireland. Well, he's getting rid of the pagan fertility beliefs. So this leads to a lot of trouble. St. Catherine of Sweden is often venerated as a saint of fertility. And I couldn't find an image, but she has a snake. Now, however, most women are demonized easily by being depicted as aged women, aged females. Here we see Hamlet. And we see snakes as the personification of evil, even in 20th and 21st century United States. We see Doré. The snake never really gets entirely associated with Satan. And you can see Satan in Doré's imagination looking at the snake. Once we've gone through this narrative that I'm suggesting today, this depiction becomes very rich for perusal. What is the snake to Satan? We're not going to talk about that now. I'm running out of time. Here she is. Popular culture maintains many, as does sort of the culture of saints, female saints, but you can see that Beyoncé is quoting the iconography of saints in the West, as well as female figures in African cultures. And so we come to contemporary depictions of the snake, some of which are incredibly elaborate and quite beautiful. The snake appears back in the garden. This is an ancient text in Greek. Here we have the snake in the garden again, shedding its skin, associated with flowers. And I'm going to end with this painting of a young person who has studied a lot. You can see all the books, and is greeting the snake. Now, as hard as it was to find poems about snakes, it was very hard because all of them are about how terrifying, all the ones I could find are about how terrifying snakes are. But let me read you one that, in order not to be terrifying, but to kind of bring this full circle, is a praise of the cycle of life. Not surprisingly, it's not about a snake. It's about a sow. And it's by one of my favorite poets, Galway Connell. So I'm going to close with this and then open to whatever conversations you want to have for however much time we have. St. Francis and the Sow by Galway Canal. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely, until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. As St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch blessings of earth on the sow, and the sow began remembering all down her thick length, from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine down through the great broken heart to the sheer blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering from the 14 teats into the 14 mouths sucking and blowing beneath them, the long, perfect loveliness of sow. Thank you so much for listening, and now I'm going to stop the share.
Wow.
Thank you, Beverly. Thank you so much. Wow. It's really an interesting thread that you've been able to weave from basically 8,000 years ago now through the present. I really appreciate that, along with all your visuals. Are there any questions?
Mac, I see Mac's hand. And we do have in the participants chat, when you click on that, there is a button that will allow you to raise hand if you want to do that. And that'll actually put it in order. Raised hands. So Mac, we're going to go with you first, and then we'll pick up raised hands.
Beverly, this was a fascinating talk, but it's so rich. I want to listen to it again. Is your presentation available online?
It will be. Thank you very much for your appreciation. It will be online on the UUCB website.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
It was really exciting, and I have people I want to share it with. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I do want to say we got permission. Some came in after we had gotten permission to record the visual, because this is a very visual presentation. And for the recording for this Q&A session, your faces will not be shown, just the voices and the questions. But for Beverly's part, her face and the visuals will be shown, Mac, just so that you know.
Yeah, let me just insert here that I want to appreciate Anne Greenwood, who's mentioned in chat that the snake with its tail and its mouth is in the crest of the Transylvanian, Hungarian, or Unitarian Church. Matthew 16, wisdom of the serpent, gentleness of the dove. Thank you for that. There was no way I could mention all the times that we do see the serpent in the scripture, and remember, it's not the scripture that so much, it's certainly not the gospels that demonize the serpent, it's the church. But also, Anne Wardell has mentioned an interesting book by Rosemary Radford Ruther, Sexism to God, Talk Toward a Feminist Theology from Deacon Press. So I think there are some hands raised.
Yes, we're going to go with Gloria. Gloria, your question, did you mean to raise your hand?
Well, this is Dwight. Isn't it a little patriarchal to associate the ox with the bull? You also have the cow and the head. You really can't tell the difference.
You know, it may be. I don't have any written proof of that. However, there's a suggestion in, and thank you for your comment, in Gimbutas's work, there's a suggestion that the horns of the ox are fertility symbols. So that suggests to me that perhaps as the Chattahoochee people, they may have had some knowledge of the uterus and the ovaries, because that's what it looks like to me. So also, you know, those cultures, I think it's mistaken to think of them as patriarchal. They were just learning agriculture, and evidently, you know, both women and men engaged in hunting, both women and men engaged in agriculture. So it's very hard to determine what the division of labor was, but Chattahoochee was most certainly not a patriarchy. So I didn't mean to get into issues of patriarchy or matriarchy with any culture that far back, just like I don't like to talk about God in any culture that far back, because, you know, God is the notion of God has gone through many historical, much historical evolution. And I prefer to speak of something that to me seems intuitively more universal, which would be energy and mystery and, you know, what cultures do with things they can't determine. I hope that responds to your comment, which I really appreciated.
All right, we have a question from Dr. Karen Voorhees. Karen?
Yes, hi. Thank you, Dr. Beverly. This was awesome.
Thank you, Dr. Karen.
Yes, I bailed out of academia as soon as I finished my PhD in cultural history. So I am a creative artist. I can be wild and creative and irresponsible. So I've been jumping up and down here. I could go in about six different directions with this. But first of all, just a side comment. The way I parse history is I basically agree with what you just said. To me, the patriarchy really starts coming online as we slide into the era where we start having writing, like the Epic of Gilgamesh, where we start seeing the goddess in a really negative light. And that's the beginning. And we go through the ancient empires, and we really, the patriarchy comes online hard and fast in the wake of the late Roman Empire with the monotheisms, which nail down this extreme dissociation of good and evil, and somehow sexuality gets pushed into the evil side, and with it women's bodies. And in order to be a good woman, you've got to be a virgin mother, excuse me. So, I mean, we're still renewing. I mean, this is part of our project going forward, is to put that back together in a healthier way. We've differentiated, now we need to reintegrate at a higher level. But what I wanted to burble, that's a big subject right there. What I wanted to burble at right now is going back to the ancient Greco-Roman world when we were not yet so dissociated. And the dual imagery of the snakes, which had not yet been demonized, because the world of nature, fertility, sexuality had not been demonized. The snakes, the caduceus, the rod of Mercury, which is has been adopted by the medical profession, symbol of healing, is twin snakes twined around a rod.
Yeah.
And that is the exact analogy. I'm sure you probably know this. That is the exact analogy with the chakras and the nadi system in the Hindu religion. It's where every time the snakes crisscross over the central rod, which is the spine, that's one of the chakras. And it's a very powerful symbol of healing. very high spirituality. Yes. And yet at the same time, we have the snakes on the head of Medusa,
yes,
which is such a negative image. But you take that back up a step and look at the entire myth. The reason Medusa became Medusa was because she was a priestess in the temple, I'm pretty sure, of Artemis. She was raped by one of the gods while she was in the temple, being a priestess of a virgin goddess. And in her rage, she turned into Medusa with a head. So to me, the symbol of Medusa with those snakes is female rage at male violence. It's female rage. And this is the question women who've been raped, typically what they say is, what do I do with the rage? Along comes Perseus, that magnificent, very, very Western macho male patriarchal, I mean, that beautiful statue by Cellini in Florence. Yeah, and he heroically slices off the head of Medusa. But what happens is out of her neck, the blood that sprang from her neck became Pegasus, who is symbolizes artistic inspiration that flies into the heavens. So these are, I mean, the world was still a world where things could mutate. We weren't so locked into our concepts then. So even that very negative, probably the ultimate negative image of the snake is the female rage that turns men to stone, that petrifies men in the face of that much female rage.
Yeah.
Even that can be transmuted into creativity.
So yes.
And I'll stop there.
Oh my God. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. You know, the, I'm speechless. This is another, I mean, this is some of the stuff I couldn't say. I didn't have time, but good for you. Let's hear from you next time.
Okay. All right. Nancy, Ann, you had a question. Can we pop to Nancy real quick and then we'll come to you, Nancy?
A couple of things. It seems to me that this presentation was a part one, a way to desensitize those of us who have snake phobias. I had emailed Beverly in advance of this and said, I can't watch live snakes, I'll have nightmares. And she said, well, that's from the patriarchy, we all have a little of it. So this seems to be a part one, kind of a way to desensitize us. So I know you have a long time interest in Mary Magdalene, and I'm wondering what's part two, and if you could speak a little bit more about her.
Oh, Nancy, you're so good. yes, I have been thinking about Magdalene for years now, and that has led me to a sense of experiential spirituality. You know, it's beginning to go from here to here for me. I think what's next for me is something that Lonnie suggested, which is to find a way to put these observations into a kind of practice and to engage with others in this practice. And I also want it would of course be on Zoom, or you know, but stay tuned. It's not going to be a book, and it's not going to be a movie. It's going to be, I mean, what I care about these days is us, me and you, us together, me and my granddaughter, me and my grandson, me and anyone who wants to participate. So we'll see, it's just a little seed for now. But I want to take this opportunity to mention that according to what I now believe, there are symbols of this sacred feminine principle that are not female persons. I consider Yeshua to be an avatar, say, of the sacred feminine. Gandhi, Martin Luther King, the homosexual attendants on Artemis in the Judaic temples way back then. This is not about gender, and it's not about sexual identity. It's about a principle. And one of the things that I get most strongly from this engagement, which in many ways began with Mary Magdalene and looking at early Christianity, is a sense that death is not, need not be fearsome, need not be fearsome, just as snakes need not be fearsome. When I'm afraid of snakes, I feel how the patriarchy, or whatever you want to call it, even before the patriarchy, thanks, Dr. Karen, but even before that, has worked to demonize symbols of the life cycle, let's call it, which were originally greatly associated with femaleness. Now, I sort of forget where I started that sentence, so I will pause there. So, Nancy, to answer your question again, it's going to be some kind of engagement with others.
Anne, do you want to take us home with, we're at 10:45 and—
Yeah, this has been a, I don't know if you can see this or not.
Mm. Oh, I know it well. I know it well, I don't know if anyone else does.
This is a picture of the Black Madonna at Montserrat in Spain. Yeah. Very powerful sculpture.
Yes, thank you, Anne.
Oh, thank you, Beverly. Thanks everyone for attending.
This was amazing.
We really appreciate your support of this program, and we appreciate that Beverly has been with us for so many programs, and they've all been wonderful. If you have any ideas for speakers, you know, we're still planning the future talks. We're planned through the middle of November. I think everybody's waiting with bated breath until that time. So we do have some things planned to help with that. Anyway, thanks so much. And we hope to see you on October 11th for Dave Roberts' talk. And we'll start at 9:20.
Thank you, Beverly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay safe and well.
Stay safe. Wear your masks.
Right.
Thank you. Thank
you. Well, dance if you need to.
It was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, hi, Diane.
Hi. Can you leave this channel open a little longer?
I'm going to keep this channel open, so you know, you just can let yourself go as you see fit. Some of you need to go on to service and other meetings, and I'm going to hold the channel open for
good. Because Beverly, I had a comment I wanted to make and didn't get an opportunity to do so. Do you have a few more minutes?
Yes, I do, and. Someone just told me he likes my house, so I have to thank him. Before we get to that, just want to mention that let me hear what you have to say, because that will be great.
Oh, okay. So early in your talk, or in a number of points across your talks, referring to patriarchy, and as opposed to matriarchy, and it seemed to me that maybe a reframing of the problem it could be useful, not as a matter of all of us men trying to dominate all of you women, but some of us very rich and very powerful men wanting to dominate everybody else, and throwing you off the track by making you want to believe that it's an issue of matriarchy, patriarchy, mm-hmm. when in fact it's mobarchy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh,
wow, David.
Wow. Thank you.
You saw back in 2010 or 11, Obama issuing an executive order saying that transnational organized crime is the greatest national security threat that we face as a nation. And this pickle that we're in right now, I would assert to you, is a very result of mob transnational crime, a great evil in action.
Well, thank you so much for that. You know, the way I see it so far anyway is the development of patriarchy, at least in what we call the West or used to call the West, is not patriarchy versus matriarchy. And I don't see any signs of matriarchy in the cultures I've been looking at in Çatalhöyük and Kukulcani. I see much more egalitarian division of labor, for example. But it's what I see is a growth of patriarchy out of something that needed to as a split away from nature and the nature in which we could feel a part of. Parenthetically, let me recommend to everybody a film that is now available on Netflix. It's called My Octopus Teacher. My Octopus Teacher. I watched it last night and my heart just expanded. It's very beautiful and very important. Anyway, I'm very glad for your comments, and I think now that gives me a lot to think about. Of course, there are other archies, oligarchy in particular, or plutocracy. There's a great deal to be afraid of, just like with the snake. You know, if a snake is poisonous, we avoid it. But not all snakes are poisonous. And I certainly don't want to go near anything that demonizes men as a group. This is not about gender. It's not about sex. It's not about sexuality. So let's put all of this into our brains and give it some thought as we sit at home knitting.
Diane.
Oh, I just want to say I've had an enormous involvement in this for almost 50 years. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, in the early 70s, 1972, I was part of a feminist art, Bay Area feminist art collective that was part of a larger national movement of looking for imagery about women that was not in art history books. I'm an art teacher, by the way, I was, and I'm a practicing artist. But anyway, there was only one source to find what the meaning of the symbols of what was called ancient art when I went to college in the 60s and 50s. It's like, it was Jungian. It was Eric Neumann's book. And so we photographed that whole book, and I taught that for decades about what was called goddess imagery to us. And eventually that grew into spiritual pagan groups and movements all over, especially in the Bay Area. It's still going on. But it affected the imagery of working artists, women in particular, that were very excited to find meaningful things that connected with our lives that were never shown to us in our entire lives. And the snake, for me and for many people, is the most disturbing because, like for me, I have a full-blown snake phobia. So the very first picture you put on the screen, I made a decision to hang in rather than turn it off and leave the conference here because it's so disturbing to look at. And yet that's pivotal in this ancient imagery and through all these cultures. And your talk has been one of the most astonishing I've ever heard in my life about this topic because of what you chose and what you arranged to show us step by step. It worked beautifully. When you go into the area, which I did, there are thousands and thousands of imagery and you just swim in it and we didn't know what to pick out, but we'd look at everything, you know. And this was in an era that started before Gimbutas was known. I mean, she became very popular in the culture shortly after these early groups in the East Bay and beyond were looking at these things. We were looking at them as image makers. Yes. See, that's different than words about symbols. It's like we were and are image makers. So what we did was tap into the power of the some of the power of the most ancient human imagery in existence and relate it to our own at times. Anyway, I had to do that little preaching.
Oh, I love your preaching. Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah. And the Unitarian Church gives a space for that, which is amazing.
Thank you so much.
Oh. And Beverly, Diane is an exquisite artist.
I can, if any of these paintings that we see in your home, Diane, are yours, I certainly would agree.
Well, yeah, you're looking into my studio. Behind me are fish. There's a fish water painting.
Oh, it's beautiful. Oh, that's beautiful.
It changed me from being a total abstractionist 50 years ago to painting things with symbolic meaning, at least to me, and occasionally people looking at it.
I need to send you some of my dreams, Diane, and see if they can spur on a custom commissioned painting of one of my dreams. She's incredible of representing beautiful.
Well, thank you for your comments.
All right, my friends, I know, you know, we're at 10:55. Believe me, our Dr. Beverly is around in the world, thank goodness. You certainly can email Anne and she can get it to Beverly. Any further questions, which I'm sure she would be delighted to answer, and we will have other sessions of as she designs some the going forwards that
I have let me interrupt. I have a website and you can find it beverlyallen.net.
Beverlyallen.net.
Like internet or hairnet. Okay, I see some comments here that I won't be able to. Yes, our fear of snakes is related to the fear of masculine sexual power. Why not? And the fear, I mean, I don't mean to be, what's the word, too blithe about it, but these are all things that come later, you know, fear of famine, fear of recreative power, very important things to think about. Thank you so much. So we probably have, you know, there's too much to talk about. I have to interrupt myself and just say thank you for listening and for participating and for conversing with me.
Thank you. Thank you.